Welcome to Wavelengths, a podcast with Amphenol Broadband Solutions.
All right, Allie, let's transition over to another topic I want to hit on with you while I've got you. I want to talk BEAD funding. This has been, a big exciting, seeding of capital for the whole broadband industry that's been on the horizon for years. You know, we're in the execution phase of making good on those funds, dispersing those funds. But in June of 2025, NTIA issued a BEAD restructuring policy notice, right? This removed a bunch of earlier non-statutory requirements, emphasized cost per location, forced states to update some of their proposals, and in some cases, it actually ended up redoing preliminary awards of this funding. This is something we didn't predict this, but we predicted on the podcast, even just a few years back, that this is going to be a protracted process, and it's really not that well organized right now to make best use of the funds. There's a lot of moving pieces, and like seeing this windfall of cash actually turn into stable broadband networks that upgrade, poor service areas or that get service out to rural communities, it's going to take a very long time to materialize. And this is only kind of adding more muddiness into, a sort of end date for this capital being deployed and put to use. People have been complaining about this, right? Just too slow, too complex, hadn't connected with anyone yet, just taking too long to materialize. So I wanted to get your thoughts from where you sit on the ground, right? How did some of those 2025 BEAD rule changes or any of the kind of the mix-up of how these funds are going to be deployed, how did that actually land with folks trying to build networks? Like, is it really impeding folks' work at this point, or is BEAD still that far-off thing that everyone's just kind of, they're not really strategizing around it too hard yet because they know that it's just not a near-term priority? What's the word on the ground?
Well, I can't report for everywhere, but I can tell you exactly from my perspective, we've spent a lot of time looking at it. We've looked at BEAD awards in multiple states or BEAD essentially opportunities in multiple states in New England, on the East Coast, out West. I have to say, just from my own perspective, we have decided not to pursue any of those. For a host of different reasons. Just has to do with, truthfully, I think there are other ways to do it, like I described before, with tax-free revenue bonds or different partnerships, where the potential for the grants and the complexity around it, as you described, is a cost that when you factor it in with the other costs, does not sort of pencil out. On its surface, it looks like something, this is great. It's essentially free money, but it's not really free. It comes with a number of conditions, reporting requirements, obligations. And whereas there are just other areas where if you were waiting for that funding, that was originally in a bill in 2021, if you recall. So it's been a long time for really none of that money to come out. And NTIA is doing the best they can, but I think everybody's aware we've had two different administrations in that period of time with two very different ideological perspectives on how government money should be spent. And that entire time had the same potential areas that were maybe waiting for or looking for BEAD funding, but had they been perhaps exploring ways to do it without government funds, there are ways to do that using existing advantage financing opportunities like, again, revenue bonds and things like that, structures like I described, partnership models, taking advantage of private capital in different places. You could have already built the network, had the subscribers, and be cash flowing by now. And we've watched that happen. So I think, and as a matter of fact, we've pursued private builds and had them done during that time. And, perhaps there could have been BEAD if we waited, but, we decided to go a different way and that's been good, I think. So again, that's just for the ones that we've looked at. I'm not saying, there are definitely great opportunities out there for BEAD. communities, I believe, will definitely benefit from this money coming out. There will be a number of broadband companies that are able to do this and do it successfully. But unfortunately, there'll be a number of others that won't. And I think too often I've seen companies that are very small and, in my opinion, are questionably able to execute the size of project that they're bidding for, actually win very large awards. And it always makes me kind of scratch my head. If you are, you know, let's say you had 1,000 subscribers, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 passings, possibly 1 million in revenue, 5 or 6 employees, and you're actually not cash flowing positive, how it is possible that you could be awarded a $100 million state broadband grant of BEAD money, I don't understand that. It certainly doesn't, I don't understand it in the underwriting, you know, and how you can make that award, how the state broadband office in that, and I'm actually describing an actual scenario that I've seen. So this is not a hypothetical, this is a real one. Obviously, I won't name names, but you know, you sit there and you kind of scratch your head and you say, well, how are they going to do that? And by the way, I saw this with ARPA, saw this with RDOF. I go back to lessons learned watching the very first RDOF auction. I think it was $9 billion. And, you know, in hindsight, a number of the companies that were awarded a very large awards. As a matter of fact, one of them, again, I won't mention, but right after they won an award, I remember getting a call from a banker saying, you know, do you want to buy this company? And I said, well, you know, let's take a look. Well, they won a lot of money in RDOF. What did they do? You know, and they said, oh, we won this award. It's, you know, X number of passings and in Y number of states. So, well, that's interesting. So, Let's really dig in. You know, who's the competition? How long is it going to take to build? You know, what are the costs going to be? What are you going to use contractors? Is it internal? Is it external? Is it aerial? Is it underground? You know, I started asking all these questions, and it was really funny because the response I'll never forget was basically like, "Yeah, so we won this award. Would you like to buy the company?" You know, they really hadn't done any work, and they had no idea, and that became apparent very quickly. And I thought, wow, you know, I. First of all, I think that's very strange, and that's not every award winner by any means. I'm just saying, but it is a surprising number. It is a higher percentage of the awards than you would expect to companies. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of these programs, they attract some really good operations, but they also attract some operations that aren't as good. And so that when you're competing against non-economic sort of other operations, it really changes the nature of the game in such a way as to say, well, why don't we let them go ahead and try that and we'll see what happens. And, you know, we kind of move on. And so, you know, again, that's not all of them. I definitely don't want to say or give any impression I think that's the entire program. It is a large part of it. And so from our perspective, we've decided really not to pursue that. It doesn't really fit our model. Again, you know, a lot of those programs, BEAD in particular, is obviously for underserved areas. Where we've found our niche to be most interesting is obviously, like I said, in the green fields. Those are new home builds. Those typically do not qualify for underserved. Obviously, they're brand new homes or they're dirt and it hasn't even been built yet. So you can't, it's not a BSL, it's not a broadband serviceable location. In the case of the brownfields that we're looking at, there are, of course, these areas that have received grants because they were unserved, underserved. But we also see a lot of opportunity where, you know, a network was built where it had to go from one unserved area, underserved, to another unserved, underserved area. And then in between, there's actually a lot of opportunity to bring fiber to those areas that technically, for one reason or another, may not have qualified as unserved, underserved, according to the FCC broadband maps, but actually make for great opportunities for private builds. And when I say great opportunities for private builds, they will have some mix of copper or coax and a lot of customers that if you bring fiber to that area, they're really excited to buy it. So that's where we find our niche more. And there's actually surprisingly more of those, in our opinion, that we can go after than necessarily kind of fighting in the particular bead areas in those selection processes. So as bead goes, that's just my own opinion and where we're spending our time. It's all very interesting.
Yeah. And so I guess in summary on that point, there isn't one blanket answer to this kind of inherent in the question, but what would you say a healthy capital stack for a fiber project looks like in 2025? Or maybe the better question is, how do you identify what your healthy capital stack should look like for your fiber project based on the resources available to you, conditions, the environment you're operating in, right? Like what should really help determine that funding model or strategy?
So I always, for better or worse, I always break everything down to unit economics. If I don't understand the unit economics, I there's no way I'm going to understand the business. So I kind of start on the inside and go out. On the inside, we look at what is going to be our all-in cost to get that customer, and then what is that customer going to produce? And for better or for worse, that's kind of how I look at everything. What am I paying? What am I getting? So I think we try to adhere to a very rigorous discipline of just looking at everything dispassionately and saying, what's our return on invested capital? We're going to spend $100. What are we getting back? In our greenfield models, we can really get our costs down on a unit basis. In our brownfield models, where we choose to go and how we partner in the particular areas are, we get equivalent unit costs to our greenfield areas. If we didn't, we wouldn't do it. So, very high level, let's just say for a unit cost model, if you can all in get a fiber broadband subscriber for about $2,000, if your ARPU was, let's just say for argument's sake, low 80s, you're getting $1,000 of revenue a year. You ought to be some of the very worst run broadband businesses, fiber broadband businesses, not on a contribution margin and not on a gross margin, but on a all-in cash flow margin, ought to be cash flowing maybe $600, let's say, a year per subscriber. So if you could build something for $2,000 and you can cash flow $600 off of it per year, now let's talk about that over time. So let's say top line growth for that revenue is maybe 4-5%. What we're observing is that because these businesses scale very well, your cash flow growth is usually 100 to 200 basis points higher than your top level growth. So if you are cash flowing, if you start a year one at $600 and you're growing at 7%, in 10 years, you're $1,200. It's just math, right? So you can figure out that your cash flow growth is very nice over time. And then you say, well, what's that worth? And that's kind of where we try to look all the time and say, where can we build and try to achieve those unit economics? And if we do that, once we get to that point, then we turn around and say, what's the most efficient, right side of the balance sheet, right? We're talking return on assets here on the left side. What is our return on equity is on the right side. How do we finance that? How do we finance that, in different stages? So we might start with private capital. We might then start working with different term loans with our financing partners. We might then get to a level, like I mentioned earlier, where you could be eligible for some warehouse going into an asset-backed securitization. And then once you do that for a while, you can get actually to issue an asset-backed securitization. So there's this sort of process you can go through where you can continue to optimize that capital stack over time. And that's something that we want to do. So what's optimal for the capital stack day one will be different than, a year later, 2 years later, depending on the size of the growth of the business. But what won't change, in our opinion, is a discipline to try to find the unit economics model, which makes sense. And if you can just focus on that and make sure that you're being very honest and disciplined about pursuing that, those particular economics, whether in greenfield or brownfield, the rest of it will kind of work itself out. I will say in the current environment, there is, in our opinion, no shortage of telecommunication infrastructure capital out there. There's very large funds. They're all the way down to more targeted funds to family offices and high net worth. There's lots of people that are really understanding the attractive unit economics of this business.
All right, Alex, I want to talk tech now. We're a little tight on time, so I'm going to kind of combine a few different topics into one. So bear with me here, right? But let's talk about some of the market shakeups and how different lanes of connectivity technology evolved in 2025 and what this really means for fiber and broadband at large. So a few key updates, right? Research, for example, shows that this year, fiber and fixed wireless access drove the bulk of new broadband adds, while traditional cable actually kept losing subs in 2025. That's point one. Point two is that in response to that, to maintain relevance, we saw major U.S. cable providers spend their 2025 accelerating DOCSIS 4.0, high split upgrades, really doing everything they can to boost upload speeds and remain relevant and compete with fiber and FWA, which analysts were calling one of the biggest architectural changes in cable networks in a long time, maybe like last 10 years even, to put a number on it. And then on top of that, you mentioned it yourself in some of your earlier answers, right? But we're starting to see an expansion of low Earth orbit satellite players like Starlink, like Amazon's project, right? And those are ramping toward broader service, positioning non-terrestrial networks, as a real option alongside fiber and fixed wireless access. So the whole ecosystem is evolving. Legacy players are trying to keep, you know, their relevance. Fiber and fixed wireless access are gaining dominance as if they weren't already, right? Low Earth orbit satellite players becoming a real viable supplemental option for connectivity services. How would you say the like pie chart has really changed in 2025, right? And where does this really position the fiber side of things and the makeup of broadband connectivity services today? Is cable really that much out, you know? Is fiber and fixed wireless access truly the new standard in 2025? Lock that in. Should we be looking at satellite as a competitor or as a supplemental connectivity player if you are an ISP or you're laying fiber cable, right? Give us your thoughts here on what really shifted in 25.
Sure. No, all great questions. In my opinion, there's a misperception that these are all equivalent and they're all options. I think that's the common misperception. In reality, they're not. I think you said it twice. You said the word supplemental. That is really important. They're not equivalent, and they're not equivalent for both physics reasons and for costs reasons. So let's first talk about the physics. So everything that we know of when we're talking about broadband or internet, we're talking about literally moving their waves, right? We're talking about electromagnetic spectrum. So you're with your satellite or fixed wireless or coax or copper, what you're doing is you're moving an electromagnetic wave down a piece of metal, or you're bouncing it off a satellite back down to the ground. But it's basically a radio waves. In fiber, you're using a much higher frequency in the electromagnetic spectrum. Not to get into the weeds on physics here, but you're using light, right? It's and on the electromagnetic spectrum, you have radio on the lower end, you have much higher frequency of light, and in the physics of it are light over glass, for a number of different reasons, is a far, far superior medium for transferring large amounts of data, both downstream and upstream. Nobody's going to argue that. That's just physics, and it won't change. So these things have to be viewed in terms of what they're capable of doing and where they fit in the ecosystem. And that's why I think supplemental is a very good description. As I talk to you today, I am talking to you over an all fiber connection at my home. But guess what? I also have Starlink, and I love it. And I put Starlink in my car. I have a little Starlink mini dish in the back of my car with suction cups plugged in that turns on when my car turns on, because there's no cell service up here. So if I want to make a phone call, when I'm taking my kids to school or picking them up or going to Boston, I need that thing because there's no cell service. And it works great, by the way. It's fantastic. I'm a huge fan. But I think of Starlink and low Earth orbit as a tremendous supplement and piece of the puzzle to a total architecture solution. And I think it's great because when you're looking at one of the things that I think has been a big improvement in the BEAD program was in the prior versions of the BEAD program, it was an overfit for fiber only. That there are scenarios where that just doesn't make sense. I could show you, I have neighbors who live on the top of a mountain, and to run fiber all the way up to that guy's house is going to eat a ton of cost and capital that could be available to all the other neighbors to have it. And you could give that guy Starlink and they'll be great. And he would be happy and everybody would be happy. And money is not infinite. So if you all of a sudden have less money to deploy, you start having to be more creative with how you're doing it and use more tools in the toolbox. And Starlink and the low Earth orbit satellites are an excellent tool for that. Now, too often they get confused with, is that something that can completely substitute like a fiber connection at home? Well, it can't and it won't. And don't take my word for it. You can listen to Elon Musk talk about that. I mean, there's a podcast he gave recently where he went through the exact same thing. He's talking about the physics of something that's 300 to 500 miles above the Earth, moving at 17,000 miles an hour. It's just never going to be able to compete, even in fixed wireless, with a radio that's a mile away. That's not moving. It's just physics. So now what it can do is it can provide service to areas where it doesn't make any economic sense to put fiber or even fixed wireless or cable there. And that's actually really, really important. So it's not either or, it's yes and where do they fit? And so I think from the perspective of everybody having some good high bandwidth solution, it's a tremendous piece of the puzzle. I think fixed wireless is very cheap to put up, and we acquired and own fixed wireless businesses. And in each case, we bought them because they were fibering their footprint. Now, again, you have to go back to the physics of it. There are physics limitations to how many customers you can have off of one radio in a particular area. And as it becomes more congested, you can service less customers. So it is a solution in certain areas, but is not the solution, nor will it ever supplant a wired solution, especially fiber to the home. So it is something that you can put up very quickly, but then you have to bring up cost. So those radios depreciate much faster and are much more expensive to maintain over a shorter period of time than fiber. Fiber is more expensive to put up initially, but its long-term maintenance costs are much lower and it's much more secure than much more cost-effective, I would say, over time than fixed wireless or satellite. Remember, it's not cheap to launch 40,000 low Earth orbit satellites and keep them in low Earth orbit and have them going up on rockets. It's actually, if you look at the total cost of a fiber network and the amount of bandwidth you get and the use you get over, remember those satellites will last maybe 4 or 5 years, and then you'll have to replace them. So you have to look at the cost over the total period. So it's not just physics, it's also cost. Put all these things together, I think everyone would agree, and you do the math, fiber is the solution for most homes long term. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be good solutions for low Earth orbit satellites. That doesn't mean there won't be good opportunities to use fixed wireless to supplement. You can tell I probably purposefully have not really talked much about cable and coax. I think there it's more a question of capacity and what people are going to use the network for now and going into the future. So an increasing amount of users are using 700 gigs a month, going to a terabyte a month, going to 2 terabytes a month. And usage is like this. And why? It's because we're having conversations over video at home. We have extremely high quality cameras on all of our iPhones and cell phones and Samsung phones. We're constantly taking pictures of our kids and our dogs, and they're uploading into the cloud, and we're sharing them with friends. We're playing video games. We have 4 and now 8K televisions, streaming services. And that one little thing that we didn't talk about with technology that obviously has been very big over the last couple of years AI and artificial intelligence. It seems like every day there's another tool that's coming out where you can do all kinds of amazing things with this technology. Increasingly, you're going to need and rely upon high bandwidth capacity, both download and upload. So when I say and upload, we all know the fastest growth is on upload. People are producing a lot more in terms of data that they need to push up to the internet. And that wasn't the case 10, 20, 30 years ago when coax was sufficient. So you can go to DOCSIS 3.1, 4.0, whatever might be in the future. Whatever they can do in a lab or in real life, it will still cost more in the long run and will still be technologically limited in comparison to fiber. And that's why I believe long-term fiber will be in every connection to the home. It is, by the way, that way most everywhere else in the world. So in Europe and Asia, fiber connections are more or less ubiquitous. It's really just in North America that we're behind. There's a whole bunch of structural and historical reasons for that. But again, my opinion is that in the next 5 to 10 years, pretty much every home and every premise in the country will have fiber. And that will be, if you talk to any broadband business on when they're what they're doing in new home construction, they're almost always putting fiber in. So you'll have a great fiber backbone for our general internet networks across the country. And then, of course, all these other things are great supplements. Like I said, Starlink, I think, could possibly compete with the cell phone carriers for cellular connectivity. I think by their own admission, they have no intention, capability, or desire to really replace terrestrial wired fiber connection. So that's how I view those different technologies. It has to do with, you know, how much bandwidth you need, what you're using it for. Maybe a good analogy for this, by the way, just might be like, you know, you can get a generator to run something off the grid, but you wouldn't really want to run your house off of that all the time, right? 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You would want to be hooked up to the grid. And maybe that's a good analogy. And it might be a good analogy too. Like, it just depends on what you want to use it for. You know, you can get some rabbit ears and you can watch whatever's broadcasting over the air. You can get basic cable, you can expand a cable, or you could get, you know, everything you want, anytime you want on video on demand and streaming. So it just depends on what you're using it for. I will say one thing. I often hear people say, what do I need all that bandwidth for? Why do I need to have a fiber connection? I often hear engineers usually say, you don't need a gig speed or 2 gigs. You know, your TV's only pulling this or that. It really reminds me, if you go back 100 years ago, right, in the early 20s, there's a lot of literature out there. It's kind of fun to read. You can go search for it anywhere, Google it, and go look at AI. There's a lot of people that were saying, you know, why do we need electricity? You can find these articles that are saying, you know, yeah, that might be great to have light bulbs in New York City, but we don't need that out here on a farm. We don't need that in the countryside. And if you're looking like the early 20s, there were some early farms that adopted it. And then you hear these articles of people writing about the magic of electricity when they brought it to their farm. All of a sudden they had refrigeration, they had light, they had machines and appliances, irons, washing machines, things that could be otherwise having to be done with a generator, but with a hand cranking or using some sort of a gas powered something. And it brought this amazing new way of living to an area that never knew what they were able to do with it. So, you know, we're sitting here watching. Every day there's robots, that I believe are coming. You know, AI is changing the conversation for everything. I have no idea what the house is going to look like 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But I can tell you, but I think great certainty that having a reliable, high speed, high bandwidth, both download and upload speed internet connection is going to be essential to whatever that house is going to be. So we look at it as building essential infrastructure. We look at it as no different than building electrification or maybe, you know, even before that, railroads. And we're excited to build that kind of infrastructure. And it's an exciting time to be a part of that kind of a build. So, you know, we talked a lot about return on invested capital, but I think there's something else. So everybody that is involved in this business should be excited about being part of building essential infrastructure for the future and really having. I think that brings a lot of meaning. It certainly brings a lot of meaning to me. I've been involved in a lot of businesses and I haven't found one that is personally as exciting and meaningful. And as that. And I think essential infrastructure and broadband really is an exciting time.
All right, man, we've covered a lot. I want to wrap things up with just one last question here. Of everything we've covered, right? Like, things can happen in the span of 12 months that feel really consequential, but then over the next 12 months get undone or are proven to just have been a stepping stone in a much larger shift. I'm curious what you think 2025 permanently changed, right? Like, there was a clean break between this quarter of a century and the next one. The 2025 locked in about how we finance, how we build, how we operate broadband networks in the U.S. What is just irrevocably different moving forward after this year's changes, in your opinion?
And besides being able to watch everything on ESPN on my phone, is that okay? All right. Besides that, yeah, something more. But that's a really good question. I think there has been a shift, and I would probably this year more than any other year in my experience, because of all the things you said, the growth in fixed wireless customers, the loss in cable subscribers, the growth in fiber across the board, we're seeing acceleration everywhere, the amount of capital going into the industry, the opportunity to get all streaming services, obviously an increasing usage of AI and all the different things that it brings, whether it's now creating videos with a single like text prompt or something like that. I think in aggregate, all of those things this year have definitely created a desire on a broader group of people to really appreciate how important having a really good, strong broadband connection is for everything they do. I mean, there's no doubt that during COVID, when everybody was working from home, the importance of a good broadband connection was realized by everybody. I mean, it had been before, but to different degrees, people relied on it or didn't rely on it. But I think everybody realized, oh, now at home, I really need this. But I think in the last couple of years, it got to this point in 2025, for all the reasons we've discussed on this podcast, with financing, it's technology, it's AI, it's what's available on streaming, it's the different methods that you can do to accelerate the builds in areas that otherwise maybe wouldn't have been built. I think more people that we talk to, customers, current, potential, and state broadband offices, rural, and even developers and home builders, the conversation's much easier now. I think even last year, there was still a, why do we need this? And maybe if I go back to that thought about electrification. I don't know what exactly the year was when the turning point was people stop saying, why do I need this, and start saying, I need this. Maybe that was 2025. We won't know until we look at the data. But if you're putting me on the spot and you're saying what changed about 2025, I would say maybe because of all those things, people now are saying, I need this versus why do I need that? And I think that's an exciting development, not just for the industry, but for all the things that the industry are going to allow us to do.
Leaving on an optimistic note here for really technological adoption and adoption of change. I love the electricity example because I think it's perfect, right? And can be applied to really any of the topics we touched on, whether it's the kind of supplemental connectivity options that are rounding out what standard broadband service looks like today, whether it's financing models for, rolling out new broadband infrastructure. Regardless, the way we used to do things only stays that way until there's a critical mass shift. And I think on a lot of these fronts, 2025 may have been that critical mass shift where we move on from, is this the new way of doing things, to I need to adjust to the new way of doing things, which means that the folks that are out there who have been proactive on these changes are probably in a good spot because now there's a lot of reactive kind of, okay, let's get our ducks in a row action. So if you were proactive, good on you, but the competition is getting stiff again. People are catching on, and now it's a new opportunity for people to find ways to stay one step ahead of the next year or 25 years of change, which is, I can't even begin to predict what that's going to look like. So for now, we'll leave it to just 2025. Alex, thank you for your insights and your input today. This has been fantastic. Again, I said we were going to cover wide but thin, which is true. We covered a lot, but only dug this deep. So much more to dig into, and I hope we can bring you back on the podcast soon for more follow-ups. Again, folks, we've been chatting with Alex Rozek. He's founder and CEO of Mack Mountain. Alex, if folks want to get in touch with you, if they want to tap into your thought leadership, they want to work with you, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure. Really simple. Alex at Mack Mountain. That's MACMTN.com. Just A-L-E-X. Happy to email me. And you can also go to our website, MACMTN.com, and contact us through there too. We're happy to hear from anyone and everyone who would be interested in partnering with us. And we do think the partnership model is very unique. And being private allows us to do a lot of things that, you know, we couldn't do when we were public. So we're very excited, meeting great partners all the time. Excited about what the industry can do, and there's just so much to do. So please do reach out to us. We're happy to have a conversation anytime. And the team is, we just actually had our 2026 meetings internally yesterday, and our holiday dinner and celebration. So everybody's really excited for 2026, and happy to hear from anyone and everyone. So, you know, thank you very much for having us on. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast. I'm certainly happy to come back anytime.
Absolutely, man. Spirits are high and ready to get to work. So looking forward to a productive 2026, and I have a feeling we'll be chatting again soon. But till then, everyone, Alex Rozek, founder and CEO of Mack Mountain, thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning into today's episode of Wavelengths. Today, again, was a 2025 broadband year in review with Alex of Mack Mountain. If you like what you heard from Alex, you want to tap into more of his thought leadership, find him on LinkedIn, shoot him that email at alex@macmtn.com. Head to their website, check out all the great work they're doing, especially pioneering around broadband as a service models. But folks, that's it for today's episode. If you like what you heard on our end and you want to tap into more thought leadership from us, make sure you're subscribing on Apple Podcasts and Spotify for more of the latest, the minds and the market movers shaping broadband. You can also head to our website, amfinalbroadband.com, for more on our solutions and services, more resources, and of course, more episodes of the show. I'm your host, Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B. Happy 2025, folks. We'll see you in 26 with more on Wavelengths.